Namaste and welcome to another edition of the Bharat Varta Weekly. I'm Roshan Karyapa. I have with me Abhishek Paul and Nirav Kanudra to run you through the news and events of the week that was. It's a rather somber mood today. We are talking a day after the very tragic train accident in Odisha, where upwards of 200 people died, unfortunately. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about Rahul Gandhi's controversial statements in his US tour. And of course, the GDP numbers are out, and we'll discuss a few of the nuances related to that. Before we begin, our prayers with all of the families that have been affected. I really hope people find solace and find the strength to move on from this tragedy. Nirav, Abhishek, we put out this very exciting episode with Peter Zeehan in the Velina's Talk series. What do you guys think about it? Nirav, your thoughts?
Yeah, so Peter Zeehan has a new book out, and he talks about like the breakdown of the global geopolitical order. He has one very set of radical views. So it's always interesting. So his belief is that demographics will lead to the demise of China as well as Russia. And he's very bearish on Europe. The two areas that he's like very positive about. So US plus Latin America. So he says US and Mexico is kind of one block. And then Argentina and Brazil, he's very bullish on. And then Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Vietnam, and all of Southeast Asia. He says that India is the next rung about like where it's positive things. But he says that India as a country can't agree or ally with anyone. It's kind of always been non-aligned, etc. And lastly, and there's a very pertinent observation, all this talk about like a BRICS currency alternative to the dollar. So he says when you put India and China together in one group, these two countries never seem to agree on anything. So nothing's ever going to get done. So it's quite a controversial view. But all in all, I think it's a very valid viewpoint. And maybe it's not the mainstream view on everything, but definitely worth a listen. It's very interesting, very nice independent thinking. So that is very nice. And I wasn't following him earlier on Twitter, but now I have started.
Right. Abhishek, I know you were looking forward to this episode. What do you think about it?
Yeah, it's always fun to listen to Peter Zeehan. I mean, I discovered him maybe a year or a couple of years back. He has his own YouTube channel where he makes these small 5-10 minute videos every few days or maybe once or twice a week. So he always has some very interesting views. Obviously, he's also a very sought after guest by major podcasts and media around the world, right? So, I mean, I actually discovered him via he was speaking to the Times media or somebody, right? Like one of our major publications. So, yeah, I think the big one for me, which always sort of interests me, is his very radical views on China. I think everything else, I would say, while he's not probably a mainstream, it's within the sort of realms of, you know, usual discussion. But his very, very bearish outlook of China is something which I haven't seen too many others, you know, come out with, right? Like he talks about the collapse of China as a functional nation state in the sort of upcoming maybe decade or so. But the other one, and in his broader thesis about demographics, is fascinating, right? Like he said that, and we know, we can see the data is there. I think a lot of publications these days point out, right, that none of the developed world countries around the world have a TFR of more than 2.1, right? I mean, some of the collapse is very stark, like in countries like Korea and Japan, etc. The others in the Western world, like they are below one actually, while most Western countries are between one and two. India, I think, has just, you know, gone just under 2.1 in the last year or two. But his point is that, you know, this demographic shrinking has been happening since, let's say, 1940 itself, right? But what is now happening in this decade is that for the first time we are going to move to a world where dependents are going to, you know, cross the active working population in many places, right? Which is like a new phase. Earlier we were going into a phase where the number of children were, you know, going down, right? But the working population was still much higher. But now with aging populations. He's saying basically that the dependent population itself will now sort of, you know, go higher than working age population in many countries, and that will be sort of tough for many countries to recover from, right? And he uses China and Russia as, you know, these examples. So I would definitely encourage, you know, our viewers to check his podcast out, check out his other work, etc. He's always interesting to listen to.
All right, on to the news for this week. Late Friday evening, three trains in Odisha's Bahanagar Bazar station of Balasore district collided with each other, resulting in one of the deadliest railway accidents. At the time of recording, over thousands have been injured and several hundred are dead. The railways has announced an ex gratia of rupees 10 lakh for the next of kin of the people who lost their lives, rupees 2 lakhs for those grievously injured, and rupees 50,000 for those with lesser injuries. The incident united people, where hundreds of local youth lined up at hospitals to donate blood for the wounded. Abhishek, we haven't heard of such an incident for a long time, right? I mean, it's been perhaps, you know, 15, 20 years since, you know, a tragedy of this scale has happened. And we would think that, you know, modern day technology systems can catch these things, right? And so on. But yeah, just take us through this incident. You know, what really happened? You know, what can we learn from this?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really tragic situation, right? I think last time we had such a high death toll was probably in the 90s. I could not find anything in the last 20 odd years since the turn of the millennium, right? So, yeah, I think quite shocking that not just two, but three trains ended up, you know, in this collision. There was a goods train on the track, right, at near Balasore. And firstly, the Coromandel Express coming from the Howrah side, right? I mean, West Bengal, which goes down south, right? So up to Chennai, I believe. So that is the first one, and it was coming in at a very high speed, right? So that is the first collision. And so the high speed Coromandel Express crashes into the standing goods train. As part of this collision, some of the bogies go onto the track next to it, right? And at the same time, you have the Yashwantpur Express coming up from Bangalore going towards Kolkata. And that also crashes into this whole melee, right? So really tragic, right? To have two high-speed trains colliding along with a stagnant goods train. And yeah, very tragic scenes that we can see in the news. Right now, the death toll is just under 300, but probably all of us expect it to go even much higher, maybe by a couple of hundred, because still a lot of search and rescue operations are ongoing, right? Because the whole situation itself is quite bad right now, right? With about places where there are two or three bogies on top of each other, right? So, yeah, I think, you know, all leaders have sort of reached there, including the Prime Minister, the Railway Minister, and so on. And obviously, Odisha government officials as well. And saw some news of, you know, huge lines of people going into nearby blood banks, right, to volunteer, donate their blood for the victims and the injured people. But yeah, I think it'll still take a couple of days probably for the full extent of the damage to be understood and, you know, all the people to be sort of rescued or recovered, right? So yeah, hoping that this sort of accident will now give an opportunity for the railways to relook at their safety mechanisms, probably ensure full deployment of the Kavach safety system that is developed but probably not fully deployed yet. So yeah, just very sad right now at the development.
Yeah, no, I also think that perhaps, I mean, it's time for us to fast track some of these Vande Bharat trains and, you know, modernize the systems and so on. But what does it amount to? You know, I mean, I know that it's still some amount of investigation, everything has to happen. But then do you think that this is like a human error? This is, you know, some kind of a system failed, something outdated? What do you think could be the likely cause, Nirav?
Yeah, so I think one thing is our railway minister was earlier just celebrating so many days of like zero death or zero deaths on the railways, right? It was like over, once you had like a whole year earlier, and then even right now you had like over 200 days or something. And it's a very sad incident which has happened. So one, like what Abhishek mentioned, Kavach. So it is a anti-collision system on based on like RFID. And like that one is, I think the cost is about 50 lakh rupees a kilometer. And it's been like rolled out across the country. So it's like an automatic train protection system. And it's been indigenously developed by the Indian Railways. So I think now you have to fast track that despite the costs, because the, otherwise the cost is too high. Second thing is for faults on like the railway sleepers, they have another system about ultrasonic testing that they send through like ultrasonic waves through different parts on the railway tracks. And then at somewhere else, if there's a fault, it gets caught in the thing, right? So in case, so derailment could be due to like a track failure, there's a fracture in the railway track, or the railway sleepers have been damaged or destroyed, and that leads to some kind of like a wobbly alignment between the tracks, right? So these few things, and like now safety has to be at the forefront. And I think this is a very, very sad incident. But now the good thing that should come out of it is, first you have to check whether was it sabotage? Was it like deliberately done? Two is, even if it is not, it is just due to like aging or something. So I think there's a high level committee which is going to be put on there. So what Indian Railways has done quite well is they have on the high density routes, we've been talking about it for a while, but freight trains will be moving on a dedicated freight corridor. That's between like near Delhi to like Mumbai port, JNPT port, and from Punjab going all the way to near Howrah port, right? So in the northern, where there is a lot more railway traffic. So I think that is one good positive thing. Another thing is how like we started with one Vande Bharat train from Delhi to Varanasi. But right now we already have quite a few and a lot more being coming up, right? So this way, I think the Kavach system also, which has been indigenously developed, that has to be rolled out very fast. Earlier, we just had like only done in the high density routes earlier. And if you people know, the Coromandel Express goes from Calcutta to Chennai, right? Along the Coromandel coast. So this is a relatively lower density route. So yes, it was put further back in the priority, but now everything needs to be prioritized, right? Because even a low frequency railway route in India is also like quite high density by global standards. So I think the learning from this accident need to be done. There needs to be also disaster recovery kind of thing. And now internet data and all of that is quite easy. So based on that, I think radio frequency or GPS based tracking and all of those things, you see one train is not moving, so the other train gets the signal almost immediately and can brake. I think those things are probably avoidable, as well as technology is much cheaper. So maybe these kind of systems can be put into place so that there is no signal failure behind that one train has to stop, right? So if one train is stopped, then all the trains behind will stop as well. So hopefully there is some good which comes out of this tragedy, and all the safety features, etc., are pushed quite quickly, despite any additional costs, whatever there are.
Some folks in the opposition are asking for the Railway Minister, Mr. Ashwini Vaishnav, to resign, but I think he's been among the better performing ministers, has had a stellar track record. So while this is really tragic, I think he's perhaps the best person to ensure that, you know, such a thing doesn't happen in the future. All right, moving on from the terrible tragedy, Indian National Congress leader Rahul Gandhi has once again sparked controversy overseas. On his tour to the US, the disqualified MP, gave a speech in which he made a mockery of Prime Minister Narendra Modi for doing a Sashtang Namaskar to the Sengol during the inauguration of the Central Vista. In other speeches on the tour, he once again claimed that the government has captured institutions and that religions, speech and democracy are all under threat in the country. He further said that there is, however, an undercurrent that is gaining momentum and that the opposition parties are well united for the 2024 elections. Mr. Rahul Gandhi is a strange sort of a politician in the sense that, you know, I can't think of too many people or politicians who campaign outside the country. But maybe his source of power also is, you know, coming from all of those different quarters, right? Which is perhaps why, I mean, it perhaps explains all his multiple tours to all these places, speaking in Stanford and UK and so on and so forth. I mean, I don't know what to make of this, Nirav. What do you think about it?
Yeah, so I'll tell you, like, frankly, Rahul Gandhi probably realized for, like, either fundraising for his party or to get, like, overall national. So what he's doing is, if he cannot win the elections, he is reducing the legitimacy of the elected government outside India, right? That he says that they are capturing institutions and kind of like making a mockery about, like, the Sengol. So he says, instead of the English word scepter, he used the word scepter, like sounding like skeptical that he is. But India is a large and diverse country. And the Prime Minister did something which he believes in and his faith is. So there is nothing wrong in that, right? And the thing is, I feel like very sad that this is being mocked, because a lot of people within India do offer their prayers or offer respect to the deity in this format, in temples every day across the country. Maybe this is not commonly seen in the West, but that does not make it strange, right? So I think that's, it's quite a negative thing, because there are other rituals in other countries which we may not be familiar with. That does not mean that we can mock them. See, so I think mocking was quite in bad taste.
Yeah, I think also, I mean, you know, we're shying away from the fact that, you know, the civilizational roots of the country are like, you know, what you call it, right? Dharmic, Sanatan, Hindu, whatever you call it. I mean, you cannot deny those civilizational roots. So the Sengol is a 2,500-year-old, or perhaps more, I don't know, old symbol, right? And it has existed since the time of the Cholas and whatnot, right? And it's something that all of us should own and all of us should celebrate, if anything, right? So I don't see religious polarization, except in the eyes of those who perhaps see things through those tainted shades, you know.
The history, the Cholas were in the southern part of Tamil Nadu as well. Like, even Tamil Nadu is a southern state. And Modi, who comes from western part of India, is also doing this in, like, northern part. So it's kind of, you know, like, this is national unity, national integration, right? And we are taking this kind of a civilizational symbol. And this Sengol is to go from ruling party to ruling party. And the symbol is much bigger than any one individual. And we should, like, kind of celebrate that. So I think now that earlier they were criticizing the parliament, and now the parliament is built on time, and you had another 100-year-old building, which was not up to the current functionalities of current day. So yes, now that will be probably converted into a museum, and you move parliamentary proceedings to the new parliament. So anyways, what has happened is, if you can't beat them, you go outside and criticize them, is maybe the strategy being used, and to try and tarnish the legitimacy of the current government. So I think that is what it is. Also, probably in the US, maybe NRIs might be funding, or like there are some sort of think tanks who seem to be not very happy with the current government, and like think tanks or NGOs or a lot of those organizations. So maybe it helps him in raising money for the election. But what I feel is, we will see some more. See, this is going to be a very tough political fight. And you will see this kind of decibel rise. You will see more noise around November. We've got Rajasthan, Madhya Pradesh, Chhattisgarh, and I think a couple of northeastern states, Manipur, if I'm not mistaken, have elections in November. And then along with the general election next May, I think Telangana is one of the states. There are a few more states which are going into election at the same time. So I think there's going to be a lot more noise, a lot more political noise. And frankly, while a lot of criticism has been posted by Sri Rahul Gandhi, he has not offered a strong alternative that what does he stand for or what does he have to offer. And yeah, so as a voter, and I have voted despite living overseas, I have voted in the last two general elections, made a trip to India and voted. There isn't a clear message that what would you do if you came in power. So that's what it is.
All right, moving on. India's GDP numbers are out. The GDP grew by 7.2% last year for 22-23, despite being lower than the year before that, which was at 9.1% for 21-22. India still beat every major economy. China came in second place at a modest 4.4% and Saudi Arabia at third with 3.7% and so on. India is expected to outperform other large economies for the coming year as well, and the trend is expected to continue for the rest of the decade as well. Nirav, plenty of signals have been indicating that, you know, coming out of COVID, you know, India is one of the better economies, right? And these numbers further indicate that, right? And if you look at all of the business activity that's happened, you know, whether it is Tata signing up for a new EV plant in Gujarat, or Foxconn announcing that they're going to make iPhones near Bangalore, and, you know, the Morgan Stanley report that came out with the MD Ridham Desai being very optimistic about India and so on, right? All of these multiple signals seem to indicate that, you know, we're doing really well.
Yeah, so I think, see, GDP number comes out once a quarter, and there are a lot of people who kind of claim that, you know, that, oh, GDP number may not be accurately collected. So Arvind Subramaniam, one of the previous chief economic advisors, kind of said that, right? But what we can see is the decisions taken during COVID, right? And so there are a few things which are going in India's favor. So one was that during COVID, I think India ensured that people do not suffer due to lack of food. And we had enough food grains, and a lot of farming activity was normal. So free food, I think 10 kgs per person per month of like cereal, either rice or wheat, and 5 kgs of pulses like dal were given for free. Our PDA system worked very fine. And unlike the Western world, we did not give a lot of cash handout. That kept inflation under control, that while people had enough to eat, even if they could not have a earning livelihood, we did not have any mass starvation. So I think that was a good thing, because then once you start giving handouts, it's very tough to pull them back. And that has led to a lot of inflation and those problems elsewhere. Then the second thing is, India had a big NPA crisis and a big banks were saddled with bad loans, etc. And the last of it towards the end was IL&FS going under and Punjab Maharashtra Cooperative Bank going under. This is all 2018, 2019. And since then, like, we've actually worked to like clean up bank balance sheets. A lot of PSU banks, some of them were merged. So a lot of hard work has gone into that. So now in this cycle, lending and all of that is a positive, good thing. Third thing is that you had Reserve Bank of India ensured that when our imports collapsed, they built a war chest of FX reserves so that they did not have the currency strengthen so much. So that once everything opens up, they did not have the currency weaken too much either. So they did a good thing. On petrol also, when global petroleum prices fell, they actually increased excise duties. So during COVID. So what they did was build up buffers in the good times. And then when things and oil demand increased and globally oil prices rose after like Russia's war on Ukraine, then you reduce those taxes. So that was a little bit counter-cyclical policy. So what I'm saying is, all these actions, it's not that, oh, we are lucky. Lastly, due to the war on Russia and Ukraine, we got an alternative to get cheaper oil, right? And which we've kind of, some of it excess, we exported as diesel to Europe back again. And apart from all of this, it is the China plus one story. So the world realized during COVID that China was very critical. Plus, India independently has done a lot of PLI schemes to attract investment and manufacturing within the country. We were very strong in services. Manufacturing was one sector which we are lagging behind. So what I'm saying is, there are a lot of active decisions taken. So this is all the input. What all has gone in, and maybe see one quarter of GDP being a slightly higher, etc., is not going to make me very happy. What we need is a process. Does this get repeated quarter after quarter, year after year, and it has to go on for a decade or so? And that is what actually China or earlier East Asian tigers like Taiwan, Korea, and before that Japan have done, right? We need this for decades. So we are on the right path, you can say. And then compared to the GDP number, which comes out once a quarter, my favorite indicator is the GST collection data. So GST collection data comes out. I remember talking on the podcast when we went to 1 lakh crore in about 2020. And now we are routinely crossing 1,65,000 crores. So I think the budgeted number is about 1,50,000 to 1,60,000 crores a month. And now we are crossing those numbers, and those numbers are coming higher than expected. So the GST collection is actual tax collected, right? So people have consumed something, people have spent money, and this is the tax collected. Obviously, it represents or more heavily skewed to the top half. So there are critics who criticize everything. So there's no GST collected on agri products. So this is, oh, what about the poor people, etc. But this shows the level of activity in that segment. And like obviously more luxury items are taxed higher at a higher rate of GST at 28%. Some of the essentials are at lower rates. But what this is telling you is that the level of economic activity is picking up and it's on a steady path. And a lot of these inputs have gone in. There are a lot of active policy tools which have gone in. So that is not just from the government. Second, India has got a decent demographic structure. Also, after like kind of having like a lost decade after the financial crisis in 2008 to 2019, I would say is like we've had like subpar growth. So businesses also who are overly leveraged, some of them have gone bust, and the bankruptcy code has like let their assets be redistributed. Go Air recently has filed for bankruptcy, but overall, all the businesses have kind of like some of the weaker hands have folded, but the other ones who've consolidated, cleaned up their balance sheet, they've been running very prudent policies, the companies as well. And now they are investing. So that's also a very positive sign. So unlike, again, in the West, what has happened is the companies have only bought back their own shares or like paid dividend away, and they've not invested. I think the Indian companies are investing right now. So I think all these are very positive signs. And what I want is, we keep beating expectations month after month, quarter after quarter, and years to come, right? So that is where the real momentum is. There are critics for everything. And obviously, any number you put out, somebody will say that something is wrong. And like one number doesn't make much, right? Yes, we are happy about it. But this has to be repeated over and over again, over years. That actually sees visible difference to rest of the country. Another positive thing is, when the GDP grows faster than expected, then tax collections are a little higher than expected. So what the government can do is either borrow less or spend more on infra, spend more on actual things which have a bigger multiplier effect. So we get into a virtuous cycle. So I've droned on a lot, but I think all of these things are very positive, and we should celebrate them and continue working hard so that this continues to go ahead.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, on that somewhat positive note, in a rather tragic time, we bring the podcast to an end. Thank you so much for joining us. If you've liked the content, then don't forget to share and subscribe this podcast. Follow us for similar content on politics, policy and culture. Once again, our thoughts and prayers with all the families who've been affected by this terrible tragedy. I hope you guys find strength. From Abhishek, Nero and myself, thank you so much for joining us. Do stay safe, take care, and see you next week. Jai Hind.